Our first speaker for today is Thomas Fenning from Microsoft, who will talk to you about SMB version 2. So,
good morning. Good morning. You can hear me? Okay. Good. So, good morning. Welcome at the early hour. Thanks that so many people showed up. First thing I want to announce is, while only my name is on this on the sheet, we actually have a split talk. I could talk a little bit about sort of the overall design of SMB v2, and then Jim Pinkerton, he is an architect in our team. He's going to talk in more detail about the efforts we have done and the investigations we have done, trying to sort of scale our protocol that it operates well from kilobits to gigabits. And so here we go. Just giving you a little bit background, what we do, how I got to basically work on SMB, then talk about the version 2 design goals. I mean, this protocol probably got dropped a little bit from the sky, and there was not much sort of collateral around why we did it and how it came about. So I can talk more about that. Then talk a little bit about the sort of how we ended up tuning the protocol for WAN, and what we saw by sort of doing a deep analysis, frankly, of the Microsoft corporate network and some of the problems we saw there, and then how we started sort of developing strategy around that. And then we go into the performance comparison and sort of work through the layering, the bottlenecks, the test environment use, and what we see. And then we have a question section. SMB legacy, most of you in the room are probably like very familiar with that. And I just want to use the opportunity to talk a little about like the SIFs and SMB thing and what we mean when we say SIFs and what we mean when we say SMB. And very simply put, if some of you have looked at the documentation, I take it, and there's a different set of documents. There's an SMB v1 document, there's an SMB v2 document, and then we refer the SIFs document. What we mean when we say SIFs is the version of SMB that shipped in NT4 server. And right now there is an effort underway of potentially doing an update to that so that we can start with a clean slate, everything that shipped up to NT4 plus all the extensions we made afterward. And when you think about the stuff that got added later, this was like Kerberos and domains, shadow copy, few things, server to server, the shortcut, and like SMB signing, plus a few other minor things. But so it should be clean, at that point should be a clean set into SIFs, SMB, and sort of NT4, plus everything that went after. So if you go doing an implementation, you can simply layer it as that. Long legacy in the SMB world, when you go back, the networks over which this was implemented and the environments were very, very different to what it actually now ended up being used at. So the design goals back then were, and the environments on which the initial development was done, was very, very different than what we see now. So a lot of the assumptions back then turned out not to be very true, and so that led to some of the extensions throughout the years. And we accumulated an enormous amount of redundancy, non-orthogonal commands, things that were brought in by specific vendors, and we just created like a lot of sort of legacy code and a huge test matrix of interoperability just to keep the boat running. And so a big driver was whenever we were trying to make any change to the protocol, and you got about like some 100 commands, even if you like blow at one end of that code base, so many things trickle through and you can't actually keep it running. And so one of the big things was we realized at some point, in order to innovate on the protocol code base, we just needed sort of a new code base. And so a big driver of where this came from, we just needed a new code base in order to do innovation. And so one of the trends that were sort of the overarching driver for the whole project was that branch was happening. Branch had been happening in the US for a while, and everyone had branch offices, more and more branch offices, and then everyone started outputting servers into these branches, but that created very, very high cost and overhead. So eventually people sort of tried to roll these servers back into the enterprise, consolidating file servers, consolidating servers overall, putting it all together. And at that point, people were getting pretty bad results. Now, The other thing has happened to the clients anymore. The people were not actually connected to LANs anymore, but they were connected via wireless, via cellular modems. And so what we ended up with that the overall experience that we're giving was degrading. So networks were getting better, everything was getting faster, file server experience was getting worse and worse. That was not a good situation. And it led to this interesting market of WAN accelerators. So if you think about it, because our protocols don't really work that well over these networks, we created a $1 billion, almost $2 billion is your market for devices to fix that problem. And that's okay, but on the other hand, you can start thinking about, well, why don't you do it right to begin with? So some of the thought that we put into it is, well, why don't we basically fix the things that are wrong and see whether we can make this work over these networks? So I start out with the overall because I think that is a sort of has been a long-standing question, like why did we did what we did? And then I go back and sort of drill down into sort of the network analysis we did. SMBB1, if you count like all the transact and different versions, we got more than 100 commands. Or opcodes, whatever you want to call them. So when you think about a feature like shadow copies, well, what you would like to do is you like to do like a clean implementation. Well, it turns out the way this works, we would have had to make like an unbelievable amount of changes to the code base. Since that wasn't really possible without sort of too much risk, we ended up just doing like name decoration. It's the only way to basically cleanly integrate that was just like inventing sort of this name, this sort of naming convention, because then you don't have to touch all these 100 commands of how you build it in. And you start thinking, well, is that really the right thing to do? And so one of the things for that we wanted for SMBV2, basically get this scaled back to an orthogonal command set, and then for the future, design it in a way that, let's say we wanted to, let's say NT comes up with a version file system, different than what we have now, really file versions into NTFS. How could you add that to SMB without having to invent yet another new command? So there's now extensibility mechanisms built into the protocol, and you probably saw sort of there's these context blocks, a chain of context blocks you can just pass into a create. There's a single create. Well, new things come along. We can just like invent new blobs, document those, and sort of the code stays compact. For some of the other commands like reads and writes, sort of we came up sort of with this crutch at least. So there's a variable offsets. You got offset fields that are no longer fixed. So if you eventually might need larger headers, you can basically sort of shift like the actual payload like a little bit out without having to invent new commands. Symbolic links had been a long-standing thorn. So while we were at it, we were just adding symbolic links. And then the other sort of once you sort of do the minimal command set, you end up with a problem. A lot of the commands that were added to SMBV1 over time were basically chains. Very complex commands meant to sort of accelerate things that were taking too many transactions. Because we ended up having these long latencies, sort of users were having a bad experience. Now you have like 19 commands. How do you get these command chains back? Well, we had the endx that existed in SMBV1. But there were all sorts of like not really well understood restrictions about what can be changed, what couldn't be changed, and particularly on our code base. So we came up with a much better compounding mechanism. And while we were at it, we sort of added basically two modes. One, you can bundle up an arbitrary set of commands, or you can sort of bundle up command chains. Different is one get executed in order, and the other one is sort of executed in parallel. And sort of one, that's sort of, when you look at NFS4, they did something similar. In our case, every single element in a compound statement gets a return code. So this might lead to sort of chains where you do a create, you do something, and you do a close. Well, if the create fails, you need to be a little bit intelligent of how you deal with it. But in practice, we found it's definitely worth it. So if you do a little bit of the right thing, then you can at least have the close. And overall, it works out. Right now, we're sort of in a phase where we're looking to sort of improve like the level of compounding. The first raw version of SMBV2 was actually more chatty than SMBV1, obviously. And so we're now working our way back and like hopefully better than what we had before. Another big feature, when you think about these networks, and particularly cell phones and cellular connections come to mind, is you have relatively often connection loss. And for the SMB world, that basically meant mostly that there was an error code signaled up to the application. And some applications tried to work around it, like Office has like very special code and trying to sort of deal with these kind of situations. But it always required the application to be smart about it. And very often, sort of, you could only get around it by working off local copies and just like sort of using the offline file, like in an offline file mode. And so we wanted to have a method where we basically use sort of the state, like an NFS, you connect to a file. But in our thing, the stateful thing is a session. So we wanted to something that you can reconnect to a session and the state can be maintained on the server and the client sort of needs to remember what were the operations in flight. And then you could reconnect and sort of replay the things. That works relatively well. However, it creates sort of an interesting interesting dilemma. Like what do you do about like an appended write? Those, you need to make sure that you only execute it once, otherwise you end in trouble. So a simple way out of that situation is if you look at oplocks. And you basically only execute these things against files where you hold a batch oplock, then you basically know at this point, like the server has an easy way on how to deal with like conflicting access from other nodes. Since at this point, once you have the oplock, there is no conflicting access. You know, go ahead.
Regaining of oplocks then? Because the problem with batch oplocks is a long-lived file, it tends to lose its oplock at some stage and never regains it in SMB1. In SMB2, are you expecting the client to actually regain an oplock on an open handle?
Yes.
Okay. And it will be done by the client without the application intervening.
There's some. I talk a little bit about oplocks later. So we're oplocks obviously is like an area where a lot of your performance comes from oplocks. And I mean, you have looked at the traces. When you open like Office documents today, there's interesting things happening that you might not actually for like a normal Word document. You never actually keep your oplock. And so we're actively thinking about how to basically improve the oplock logic. But yes, so the bottom line is right now in the copies that we have, we sort of we only do the reconnect when we hold a batch oplock, because that sort of very, very much simplifies the code and sort of you don't have to deal with all these special cases where the client really has no good knowledge of finding out whether there was an idempotent operation before. And so that makes it easier. The crediting mechanism for the number of outstanding operations, Jim is going to talk a little bit about it in more detail, but for like most intensive purposes, there wasn't a lot of parallelism and not a much of streamlining of how the SMB, our SMB implementation, not the protocol, but how our SMB implementation was dealing with multiple parallel outstanding operations. And what that led to, that sort of on pipes with a very, very large bandwidth delay product, we pretty much only could get a very, very low throughput. You take a gigabit network, and let's say an XP, on a good day, you could maybe get 100 megabits. But that was about it, and that was like under very low latency conditions, and if you varied the environment, it was very inefficient. And so we needed to, that was one of the issues. And then the other issue, sort of that we tried to kill the same bird with two birds with the same stone was, for very large file servers, we ended up not being very fair in terms of how the resources were allocated. So some people get very good service, other people get very bad service, and we had no mechanism of basically trying to sort of do fair scheduling of how people, how the experience was. So we basically looked at some of the research out there, and DAFS had this crediting mechanism, and we took a good look. And so we're using the crediting mechanism for both trying to get maximum bandwidth delay product on large latency pipes, but we also use it for basically scheduling of a large number of clients on the server, because depending on how much credits you give out, then sort of a single client, sort of you can arbitrate between them. I mean, the Moore's law also applies to file servers, and when the SMB protocol initially was conceived, 16-bit fields in many cases looked like very large, but like having more than 65,000 users on a file server, of course, is a no-brainer today, and having more than 64,000 sessions is a no-brainer, and like wherever sort of we thought there was a need, we sort of upgraded the fields, which now it's sort of a little bit more stable for large servers. On the other hand, header size has gone up tremendously. So now an interesting question is some form of header compression probably might come in useful, which is something we're looking at. The past code base, again, not a protocol thing, had sort of this notion that like when you were working on notifications or any outstanding operation, even if they were long-standing, we're counting towards the sort of towards a number of concurrent outstanding things we could do. And we had a very low number. And sort of if you were just doing the wrong things on your connection, you were eating up all your outstanding operations and your performance suddenly got like completely unpredictable. So we were just asking for a couple of notifications on files or on certain things. Then suddenly you actually read-write speed just dropped to the floor because it was served from the same queue. And so now we explicitly make it sure that these long-standing operations are being handled by a different queue. And so your file speed, your transfer rates are independent from what you do, which also sort of makes it much more predictable. Probably everyone in the room knows that MD5 has a well-known crypto attack that sort of allows you to sort of crack it on a modern machine relatively fast. And so we went from like MD5 to HMAC MD5, but obviously for liability reasons, a security issue, we wanted to make sure that the signing algorithm gets to something that at least doesn't have like a known crypto attack on it. So we implemented SHA-256. And so that should provide us some breathing room there. Right now, we only use 128 bytes, and the other one is like a fixed seed. But sort of the algorithm sort of by in itself sort of at least gives a much higher security. And so the last one is sort of a little bit of an odd one out. What we found is that we got this VC count, the virtual connection count thing, that sort of initial connection sets us to zero. And then any subsequent connection from the same IP address with a VC count of zero kicks the first session out. Well, if you happen to have like NATs somewhere in the middle, which very many people have, what it does, it disconnects like the first client. So now we basically completely killed this concept of this VC count, and but a lot of people are now a lot happier in their homes because they actually use NATs in their homes, and this now works. What this also leads to is you can actually think about using that mechanism to do much better things with multiple concurrent connections.
A lot of these changes, to take full advantage of them, you need sort of changes in the Win32 API or the APIs that programmers are writing to, particularly the compounding operations, that sort of thing. So is that following up to the sort of
nope.
The applications are
even today, the sort of whether we pick a compound operation in SMB v1 or whether we sort of do anything is all being handled at the reader level. Win32 level is pretty much optimized for the local file system. And so
that means applications aren't going to be doing compounding and the application expects the result back before it tells you what the next operation it wants is, so you can't compound.
So that's what I mentioned. The logic of compounding needs to be sort of done in flight. So you need to look at the stream of things coming down from Vim32, and we are trying to optimize. When we see certain patterns in the stream coming down, then we're trying to compound.
It means you can only really get compounding when you've got multi-threaded applications, single-threaded applications, because the Vim32 it'll ask for what is logically a single operation on the server.
Actually, right now we delay a little bit before we send things out. And then we accumulate sort of things coming down from Win32. Like all the compounding you see right now is stuff where we sort of wait a little because like Win32 breaks down an operation and sends us down a burst of requests.
There's actually two ways of compounding though. One way is exactly what Thomas just said, but the other is two unrelated processes that are sending commands.
Right.
Can you use a microphone? Can you use a microphone? Can you use a microphone?
So there's actually two ways of compounding. One is exactly what Thomas just said, but the other way is if you have two unrelated processes, we can
right.
compound those operations together into the same command. Suffice to say, though, that changing Win32 is obviously fraught with a lot of issues for us in terms of app compat, but the other side is completely agree with you that, to me, that's where you kind of need to go for certain critical operations.
If you want to allow more explicit control for it, yes.
You're not going to really beat the way, because the way the way accelerators worked, right, is pre-acknowledged writes. That was the big ace in the hole, right, that they used. And these techniques aren't going to beat pre-acknowledging writes unless you start changing things up at the API level, I don't think.
Well, pre-acknowledging writes sort of is, of course, like once you start doing that, and sort of maybe your databases won't be very happy.
Well, that's, if you sniff on the wire and watch what these write accelerators do, they pre-acknowledge writes.
Yeah.
All of the gains they get, all the rest of it's fluff and all their marketing guff. They didn't pre-acknowledge rights.
Not all of them actually do. Some of them do this kind of thing. Others actually, they work transparently and actually support most applications more in a more stable way. But you're right.
Part of the problem with
we don't encourage like pre-acknowledging rights, right?
For right. Yeah.
But the other side is the reason why they have to do that is the application that sits on top of SMB is actually poorly written. And so part of what I'm going to go through in my portion of the talk is that we change the application on top.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, sort of. Right. So the key point is like some of the key applications or some of the key users of SMB is actually not the application writer, but an internal API. And so he's going to talk about that. Yeah. Right. So let's talk about network characteristics. So since the days, so we've been working on SMB. So we ended up in a situation where the network media link speed sort of spent six orders of magnitude. And we go sort of like cellular modems, which sort of are completely unpredictable. They can go to a couple hundred bytes with like constant loss and reconnection and really, really, really bad experience. We still have lots of dial-up. There's tons and tons of dial-up out there. And where was it developed? Well, I don't know how many of you still remember like PC Network from IBM and Token Ring, right? So those were the main development platforms on which all this stuff got developed. Well, those are long gone, and the characteristics that existed on those networks are long gone. And so mainstream probably is like 10 megabits per second to like a gigabit per second Ethernet. That's sort of the most common. But in the data center, we're seeing more and more 10 gigabit Ethernet. And even going up like 2016 and even like up to 24 gigabit InfiniBand for HPC applications. So a lot of the HPC clusters today sort of use InfiniBand in the racks. And guess what? Like we don't see a lot of SMB adoption for HPC applications, and maybe there's something we should do about that. We should understand why that is and sort of maybe do something about it. And on the latency side, which is given sort of the chatting, like some of the inherent chattiness of the protocols, we see basically from less than a millisecond to up to 1,200 milliseconds. That's not counting satellite links. That's just like domestic round trip times. And well, Microsoft happened to have a large corporate network. And so one of the things we did, we looked at sort of some stuff that we just found in our own network. And we looked a little bit by continent. So we have like four data centers, one in North America, two in Asia, and one in Europe. And when you sort of do a little bit of analysis on how the timing looks like, you find some interesting data. The latency is like you sort of get in the local side or like in the metropolitan area network is around like 5 milliseconds. When you go sort of across continents, you roughly see about 100 milliseconds. And that's both true for Europe and North America. In Asia, it's a little higher. And we don't actually have data centers in South America, so all our South American traffic is routed back via North America. So that's why the first table doesn't include South America. But then sort of the variation, you see a little bit sort of you see sort of the different age of our branch build out in the different countries. So the minimum and maximum latency, the minimum latencies and the maximum latencies, so they reflect like when these things were built. And so for newer platforms, you actually get a lot better performance like on some of the min stuff. Intercontinental, when you sort of go back and sort of access the data centers from branches or from the data centers across the continents. So you're seeing like obviously massive difference, and you're seeing like more like 500 milliseconds is a norm. And the variation is quite large. And in South America in particular, what we're being hit with is that everything basically goes back, and we have a relatively it's all continental, it's basically all fiber. It's nothing goes via satellite, but you see, we got like 1,256 is the maximum latency, reproducible latency we see from some of these branches back to the continent. So it's a lot of variability into that, and if you look at the bandwidth, so if you basically go to your branches and sort of you could sort of calculate, trying to get a sense for like how are these branches all connected. And it's kind of interesting. This one really reflects the sort of the build out time. So when you look at Europe and you look at the US, then you can sort of tell sort of, well, obviously sort of the build out in Europe happened a lot later because the average link speed or the number of links, number of sites with higher speed is much, much higher. And in Asia, we expect sort of once that gets fully built out, it's going to be even higher than that. But on average, sort of you see that like the bandwidth available, like nothing is less than like a half a megabit pipe. And sort of on the maximum side, sort of it's like 155, which is pretty much like a fiber. That's sort of the link speeds we see. And we got the distribution. And so what we wanted to make sure is when you sort of take the latency and the bandwidth, that we sort of look at the bandwidth delay product. And just with these, like, when you look at these numbers, it doesn't look quite as like wild. But when you start looking at the bandwidth delay product, then you start seeing like huge variations. So this is in megabytes. So between this is already like a couple orders of magnitude that we need to scale. And we need to have an algorithm that sort of scales a protocol automatically to take advantage of these network conditions. When you go intercontinental, you suddenly see that we get like up to 11 megabytes bandwidth delay product in a pipe. And some of the really bad performance that we were seeing were just simply based on the fact that we couldn't even get close to filling such a pipe. So for very large file transfers, things were taking hours and hours, because we were just very relatively poor in performance. So this number, the 11 megabyte number, happens to be a link that we run from Denmark to Singapore on a 150 megabyte link with like a 600 millisecond latency. And so we thought, okay, let's look at that. But funny enough, 2 weeks ago, we started getting some calls from people in Redmond, and they're now using gigabit links to transfer some files there. But on a gigabit link with 76 milliseconds, you already also at 10 megabytes per second. 10 megabytes bandwidth delay product. Now, given sort of what the carriers are working on in offerings, it's relatively clear that in the very near future, we expect to see like 50 megabyte or even 100 megabyte bandwidth delay products. And once you do that and try to do file access over those kind of networks, you see very, very funky results. And so what you need to think about is how do you actually manage these links? And Jim Pinkerton, who is an architect in sort of the remote file system team, is going to talk a little bit about basically what are all the factors that actually sort of influence sort of the performance of SMB over these different WAN types. Jim?
Thank you, Thomas. We're kind of booking on time here, so I'm going to move through this pretty quickly. But one of the things I wanted to do was, one, give you a feel for what it takes when you take a more of a systems-oriented approach to the problem rather than a specific layer. In my prior role at Microsoft, I was an architect in the TCP networking stack, and we spent a huge amount of time trying to solve some of these BDP issues and congestion control issues and flakiness of the WAN issues. Thought we kicked some serious ass, and unfortunately, saw nowhere near what we predicted to see as the benefits, and a lot of that came down to we didn't take a systems-oriented approach in looking at the bottlenecks above us. And so specifically at the SMB layer and at the copy file EX layer, there are substantial bottlenecks. To me, it was, rather than staying in the abstract, I thought what I'd do for this portion of the talk was drill down just a little bit on what it takes to optimize specifically for local to remote file transfer. And in a Windows environment, that is a particular API called CopyFile EX, and that is used by a lot of our tools, RoboCopy, XCopy, Drag and Drop if you're using Explorer in Windows. Those are three critical apps that we wanted to make sure ran well on Vista and on Windows Server 2008. So when we were looking at the various trade-offs, specifically we needed to be able to scale by six orders of magnitude. Really, today we only scale by five, and what we're in the middle of working on is six. And then later on the slides, I'll walk you through some of the numbers that just came out last week in terms of what our current set of bottlenecks are. And then we have somewhat of a good feel on where those bottlenecks are and where we need to kind of push the envelope for the next round of changes to get to that sixth order of magnitude. So when we're at very slow link speeds, part of the issue is you want to make sure that you don't kill the responsiveness to the user. We have a single TCP connection for that user, and if you have a user that's saying doing a very large copy file, and at the same time they have an Explorer view to that remote file system, with the old algorithms, what we'd do is we'd queue everything up, and then all of a sudden Explorer would completely die, and you couldn't get a refresh out of it. And that really came down to head of queue blocking problems. And so what we needed to do is make sure that what was put into that serialized queue, which is TCP, we needed to make sure that what was outstanding in TCP did not block these interactive operations like Explorer updates. So that was one part of it. We realized we needed to be able to actually scale the size of the PDU in SMB to make sure that it went around these really incredibly slow links, these 64K links, we don't completely fill the pipe and have a 5 minutes head of queue blocking problem. What actually amazes me is how many people are still deploying 64K links worldwide. And in the U.S., I think it's gone way down, but worldwide it's coming up big. Thank you. So there's some balances that you have to play on the low end of the bandwidth spectrum. This talk is really more focused on how do we stretch the high end of the bandwidth spectrum. And I'll walk through very briefly what are the bottlenecks at each of these layers and talk to how they were solved. So TCP, there's really two key issues. One, you need to be able to scale the receive window for TCP. And so with Vista, we completely rewrote the networking stack. Won't go into it here because this is an SMB talk. But when you look at what we ended up having to do, we had to, one, get much better about congestion. And so all of the work that's been done in the IETF solved many of those issues. We can certainly get up to that fifth order of magnitude of BDP. Getting to the sixth one, I think, is still essentially experimental. I'll let you read that stuff offline. In terms of SMB2, the work that we did around the low end when we're going on very low speed links, this is the structure that we use to be able to figure out what size PDU we use. And so we'll actually dynamically vary the size of the PDU from 16 kilobytes to 64 kilobytes based on the measured bandwidth that's available on the specific link that we're running on. I'm running low on time, so I'm going to kind of keep moving along. And then that's at the SMB2 layer. Clearly what we're trying to do is scale not just the PDU, but also scale the BDP, which for us is scaling the number of credits. So we want the number of credits that's outstanding to be small on a low speed link, so you're not using resources, and on a very high speed link, get it to scale up to enormous numbers. When you go to the next layer, it actually turns out that this has been a huge problem and why much of the advantages that we thought we'd initially get out of the optimizations in the TCP stack and in the SMB2 stack were not realized. So we had to go in and solve this layer as well. In XP, we were doing synchronous writes. Because really, if you look at kind of historically where our operating system was, the whole OS was essentially optimized around a 64 kilobyte BDP because the TCP stack itself had a fixed size window, and the fixed size window by default was 64K, and so that's what everybody tested with. And so everybody makes sure that their stuff runs as best as humanly possible. And so by default, all the apps that laid on top of it ended up optimizing for 64 kilobyte PDU, or sorry, BDP. That was a real problem. So we ended up having to go in with Vista for SMB1. Part of it is due to the protocol, part of it is due to our implementation. We weren't able to get real crazy. We do at least support what we call 16 chunks. It's really 16 buffers of 32K bytes a piece. It is symmetric. You can argue it doesn't have to be. The main issue for us is we wanted to make sure that we didn't have multiple PDUs coming back from the read And so we couldn't go to 64K. That's why we have the 60K prior to that. With Vista RTM for SMB, sorry. Again, it comes back to our internal implementation. And that's part of why, honestly, we ended up, there's so many internal issues around our implementation by, you know, the code bases evolved for a very long period of time. And so it became fragile, in all honesty. And that was at least half of the reason why we felt we had to go to an SMB2 if we wanted to continue to innovate on file systems. And, you know, what the heck, we really felt that there was a lot of value in that. We needed to be able to start with something that was cleaner and was actually designed for extensibility, particularly along the lines that we found we needed to extend over the last 20 years. We wanted to be able to have a platform to extend over the next 20 years. And we'll actually walk through a little bit of that at the end of the talk, if hopefully we'll have time. So with Vista, what we do is we actually scale the number of buffers that we post by the size of the local file. And so if you're doing an X copy, for example, of a single file, this is actually the algorithm that we shipped in Vista for SMB2 for RTM, and then we actually modified it in Service Pack 1. We found that this balance that I talk about at the top of the slide, it's a tough thing, because the problem is there's so many darn applications out there that do really radically different things, and part of what makes this particularly difficult is we have to work well on a 32-bit OS as well as a 64-bit OS. To date, what we haven't done is done different algorithms depending upon what version of the OS you're on, and that might well be something that we'll do going forward. Got a couple of slides with real numbers. This kind of briefly walks through it. Again, I'm focusing very specifically on the file copy case from the local to the remote. We're in the middle of creating an internal test infrastructure to allow us to be able to do very frequent regression tests. What we've done previously is we do all our performance tests on major milestones, and that can be very painful. You get to a major milestone, you find out you have this huge perf regression. It can be a real problem. We're trying to get to a much more controllable process. The approach that we've decided to take is we're actually going to use RAM disks. This is not what, you know, real customers will ever see, right? The whole point is we wanted to be able to take the variance of our test infrastructure down to as small amount as possible so we can automate the performance test infrastructure to figure out when we get regressions. And so by having very, very tight tolerances, and really what it comes down to is you got to get the disk out of it, because you cannot get that kind of tight tolerance with a disk in place. And so all these numbers are internal numbers that are now external, obviously. But they're not marketing numbers, so please don't take these numbers out of context. They're what we use internally to understand what are our internal bottlenecks, and also make sure that we don't screw up and accidentally ship something that actually regresses the performance. So the test infrastructure is on a 1 gigabit LAN with a hardware emulator, and then we dial up the hardware latency. The emulated latency. It is using 64-bit OSs on both ends. The numbers that I'll show are XP talking to Win2K3 and Vista SP1 talking to Server 2008. And I apologize, we're running out of time, so we'll keep moving. I don't know if anybody can read it. so what this is trying to do is contrast SMB1 on XP to SMB2 on Vista Service Pack 1. And I'm dialing up the latency, 0 milliseconds, 2 milliseconds, and 100 milliseconds. First, it's to me, the SMB1 performance, you know, there is a lot of pain out there. This, to me, totally justifies why the heck a WAN acceleration market was created to begin with. If you look at the SMB1 latency, throughput, it goes like this, with 0 milliseconds inserted into the link. And then as soon as you even go to 2 milliseconds, we're down here, just 2 milliseconds. And then if you get into any kind of a reasonable branch scenario rather than a man scenario, it just falls off a cliff. So good, our test infrastructure was validated that in fact our customers are seeing a lot of pain and we can reproduce that internally. And then we start walking through SMB2, again 0 milliseconds, 2 milliseconds, and 100 milliseconds. It is kind of interesting to note, apologies, we're running out of time, so I'm not going to be able to go through all the points that I had up on the slides. But you can see we climbed the bandwidth curve substantially better at the high end, even on LAN. And then as we start going out into metropolitan area networks, we continue to climb the bandwidth curve. It takes a little bit longer. We start climbing at 32K with 0 milliseconds inserted, and around 256K with 2 milliseconds inserted. And that makes total sense, actually, because of the BDP product. You have to have enough of a file outstanding. This is a single file being transferred. It is not a throughput of, you know, just blast the interface with lots of files of this size. It is a single file. And so therefore, when you're down in here, you're not getting enough to fill the BDP. And you get out in here and you get commiserately more. And that's why when you go out to the 100 millisecond range, it takes a substantially larger file size. There's other optimizations we can do, so this isn't the final numbers. But you can also see this caps out. Clearly a serious problem when we start getting to 100 millisecond with a 1 gigabit link. So first, this is walking through the very specific case of the SMB2 numbers that were presented on the prior slide. Kind of walking through a little bit of what are some of the issues that you see. You can see that the curve changes substantially here. The curve changes substantially here in the LAN case. I don't want to focus on this slide, honestly, because the next slide to me is more interesting. We actually took that fundamental, you know, something clearly very bad is happening right here. And we went out and empirically verified that against the 76 millisecond 1 gigabit WAN that one of our customers was trying to deploy the file server on, and seeing really abysmal throughput, and then started playing with some of the knobs. And so the first thing we did, honestly, was we said, oh, it must be TCP, it can't be our problem. Yeah. So we then dial up all the knobs around TCP, it makes no difference at all. And so then we said, well, it actually turns out that the bandwidth throttling algorithm we do in terms of credits has issues. Measured bandwidth algorithms that are out there today, because we're not sending a packet train, we're actually trying to figure out what the throughput end-to-end is based on the existing traffic, it's not a stable algorithm. We didn't fully understand the horrible edge cases until we started getting to these extremely high BDPs, and so that was part of the issue. We put a different algorithm in, and now you can see I don't have all the data points. That's why you see just little checks here. You can see we're now climbing better, substantially better. However, that wasn't enough. What we then found was we currently allow 128 outstanding credits. 128 is not sufficient to be able to fill the BDP, and part of what I think a lot of people miss is that the latency numbers that Thomas went through, those are typical on an unloaded network. And so because of that, if you actually load the network, the variance goes much higher. And so by going to 512 outstanding credits, now you can see we're in round numbers, 800 megabits per second. And with that, I'd like to hand that on back to Thomas. We wanted to talk a little bit about some of the futures that we're looking at in terms of SMB2.
So, yeah, well, stay up here. So if you have any questions, this is a good time to ask questions. Let me just sort of quickly sort of give you a little bit of our future thinking. So this is like not an ordered feature list. This is not something that we have committed or even plans around. But when we think about SMB and we want to be relevant in 10 years out, so what does it take for like SMB to be relevant 10 years out? What would our customers expect from us? We think about sort of one of the things that's clearly become a hot issue is documentation interoperability. We need to do a better job at that, and we sort of, I think, making all the right steps. Performance sort of has many, many, many aspects, and now that we have SMB v2, there's actually a good time to think sort of through some of these issues. There's sort of the bandwidth scaling, just the stuff we showed, and we need to work on that. HPC workloads, at this point, there's a prediction that this year, about 30% of all servers worldwide will sell into HPC workloads. 30% of all servers worldwide will sell into HPC workloads. How many HPC clusters use SMB? So that's probably something we might want to have a look at and sort of figure out what that takes to it. Okay. Larger SMB PDUs, some stuff. Branch performance, there's still lots of things that can be done and should be done. And so that's actually an area that we're actively working on, trying to figure out what are some other knobs we can turn. Small file throughput, chattiness, oplocks. So when you look at NFS4, a lot of the concepts in NFS4 probably looked very familiar. But what happened was NFS4.1, they actually took it a step further. They implemented oplocks on directories, which is something that, yeah, there should be no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that as well. And so that's something we're looking at. We had some discussions about better Unix interop, sort of making sure that sort of, like when we're trying to sell our file servers, it's clear we always talk to mixed environments, and that's become more of an impediment that we don't sort of fully support the semantic. Some idea that came actually up in debugging. So people buy basically a network attached storage of any form, like the $50 disk. When it doesn't work, they call Microsoft. Now, the interesting thing is we have no idea what's running at the other end, because right now the protocol doesn't actually support some kind of a fingerprint. And so probably working together and figuring out how we fingerprint these things so that we can actually sort of save some money on the support would be a good thing. Encryption and compression, like some years back there was this belief that IPsec eventually takes care of this and you never have to worry about it anymore. I think in practice that has turned out to be a little tricky. So we are thinking about that, same about compression.
Thomas, apologies, we're running out of time.
We gotta go.
We're about to get yanked.
Okay.
I might talk to you during the break or something.
So any questions, we probably will be outside.
We can maybe take one question?
Yeah, for one question.
Or we can just take it outside.
Yeah. Over there?
Why do you vary the PDU size instead of varying concurrency or number of concurrency of same size PDUs?
I'm not understanding the question.
Why we're trying to vary the PDU size rather than sort of having more concurrency, more outstanding packets, more outstanding smaller packets?
So the real problem isn't the very slow link, the 64 kilobit link. If you look at the head of queue blocking problem, when you use large MTUs, it makes it so that any application that is actually dealing with a human interactivity element performs horribly. So you have to slice down the MTU, or the PDU, and in fact, there's an argument we need to slice it even smaller than 16K. We can talk about this offline. We unfortunately need to vacate the facilities.
Oh, I'm sorry, we have to switch now because the other talks. Thank you very much.